rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Wheelock, Judge Smith, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the 13th day of September 2023. We're here for oral arguments on four cases. The first is Schroeder Construction versus Minnesota Department of Transportation versus Goman Construction. It's my understanding that Goman has settled out of the case, so we're going to hear from Schroeder and the state, correct?
No.
It's Schroeder that settled out.
Oh, I'm sorry. I messed that up. I know. Thank you. All right, so we will begin with argument from appellant's counsel. Would you please take the podium if you need to? It goes up and down. And be sure to introduce yourself before each leg of the argument so we have it for the recording.
All right, thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matthew Morley. I represent the appellant, W. Goman Construction Company, doing business as Artistic Stone and Concrete. Your Honors, this is a construction delay lawsuit. The primary request by my client, Goman, of this court is that this court reverse the denial of my client's summary judgment motion that asked for dismissal of all the liability claims against it. Your Honors, this is a case in which the respondent, Schroeder, as general contractor to this project, seeks contractual delay-related claims and damages against my client, which was one of its subcontractors on the project.
There are a lot of issues, so I'm going to just jump in with questions and ask you to indulge us. You say your primary argument today is that we should reverse the district court's denial of summary judgment for your client.
Yes, correct.
What is your strongest argument on that issue?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor, and I was going to lead with that. So of all the factual issues that were decided on summary judgment here, there is only one issue on which we've briefed that there is no question of material fact that would preclude summary judgment. And that's the question, it's a very simple question, of whether Schroeder, as the general contractor, failed to meet what the Minnesota Supreme Court has called a conditioned precedent of pursuing delay-related damages under a contract. And that condition precedent is the notice provision in my client's subcontract that Schroeder needed to give 30 days written notice to my client once it became knowledgeable of any claims that might impact Goman Construction.
And let me jump in with a question there.
Yep.
The contractual provision to which you refer, requiring Schroeder to give notice of potential claims, doesn't have any language that says, and if notice is not given, General may not pursue such claims, nor does that provision refer to the indemnification provision or the liquidated damages provision. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking for your argument that tells me why we should read the notice provision as you suggest. That is, read it to mean that if there has been no notice of potential claims, there may be no claims.
Sure. Well, like I said, the Minnesota Supreme Court, and this is in the Buckman Plumbing case, excuse me, I'll get back to the microphone, has said that parties are free to contract as they wish on the type of notice required. And in that case,
well, let me just stop you because I've got the case here and I've read it. And
yep,
as I understood your briefing, this is the authority on which you rely. I'm not seeing any other authority.
Yep, that's correct.
And I question whether Buckman is factually similar, because although the district or the Supreme Court did say compliance with the provision in a construction contract requiring written notice to the owner of claims for damage by way of extra costs was a conditioned precedent, the language of that contract was very different than the language of the subcontract in this case. For example, it said if contractor Buckman claims any instructions, latent conditions, or otherwise involves extra cost under this contract, he shall make claim for extra cost in writing within 10 days after such instruction or observations of the conditions. So that's similar. However, the next line of that contract says, claims made after this time or not made in writing will be refused and no claim shall be valid unless so made. So in that case, we have a notice requirement and immediately after with it, a consequence provision, if you will. If you don't give this notice, you can't pursue your claim. Mm-hmm. We don't have that in this case.
Right. So, Your Honor, what I would say is I think the next paragraph in the Buckman case, where it cites paragraph 1.28 from that contract, is more similar to what we have here. And that's the similarity here. The contract provision you cited is similar to a separate contract provision we have here that, because the facts of Buckman are a little bit different. In mm-hmm. Buckman, it was a contractor right. making claims against the owner for delay-related damages. And the same provisions exist in our case, but it's not Goman making delay-related claims against Schrader. So we look to paragraph 1.28 in the Buckman contract, which is more general. It doesn't specifically refer to delay or indemnification-related claims, but it does say, just like ours, that notice needs to be provided within a certain time. And
but
that's
which claim do you think the Supreme, or which provision do you think the Supreme Court was dealing with?
Well, they cited to both of them and talked about written notice being required under both of them. But
there is some language that says, and here's what happens if we don't have notice, which is different.
Sure, but okay. In our case where we have a contract that requires written notice, it's not a meaningless provision, even if it doesn't specifically identify. Right.
But we don't have any sort of contractual analysis before us explaining, well, is this ambiguous? If so, why? How do we interpret it? What's the extrinsic evidence? Do we need extrinsic evidence? I mean, it seems to me at best that this gets you a remand on a theory that it's ambiguous and there should be extrinsic evidence to determine the party's intent. I mean, have a hard time making the leap to your client's entitled to summary judgment in its favor based on the language before us where there is no sort of, here's what happens if you don't give notice language in the contract. Do you want to have like the last word on that? Because then I would like to move on to
yeah.
some of your other issues.
So my last word would be to look at the rationale for the decision by the Minnesota Supreme Court in Buckman, which is to say, as I said earlier, that the parties are free to contract as to the type of notice that would be required. And we did here. And it's plain language that says written notice is required within 30 calendar days or less. A reasonable okay. time is the language used. So that's the basis. However, I understand the point, you know, that it might be remanded. This, frankly, is an issue that the trial court didn't discuss whatsoever in its memorandum. It was raised promptly in the summary judgment motion mm-hmm. by my client. Go ahead, Judge.
In order to, I guess I'm wondering what your disputed facts are in this case.
Sure.
Because I think that's, frankly, a stronger argument for you, but I'm...
Yeah, so the disputed facts in this case, it's our position that those all go to the underlying substance of the delay claims. What we were just talking about, Judge Larkin and I, is going to the notice provisions. There is no question of fact that there was no written notice within 30 days of okay. Schrader being told by MnDOT that liquidated damages would apply as early as March of 2020. It took them 5 months to even try to give us written notice. But yes, there's several questions of material fact on whether there were delays on this project and to what extent they would be attributable to any subcontractor, Goman included.
Is your position that, well, let me ask this. Okay, so we have this settlement. Mm-hmm. Schroeder and the state agreed these are the delays. This is the damage calculation based on the procedure set forth in the contract, as opposed to the subcontract. And as I understand it, what you're arguing is your client is not responsible for all of that delay. And your client should not have to indemnify for all of the damages attributed to that delay. And that's where you see an issue of fact for trial. In other words, you raise your defenses under the subcontract that these were circumstances beyond your control. I think both the indemnification and the liquidated damages provision tie the damages to your client.
Right. There's got to be a causation showing.
There's a causation showing.
Right, which hasn't been done here. And there's material questions of fact about causation.
What are the material questions of fact in your view?
Well, you have multiple representatives from Schrader prior to them entering into this settlement agreement that had, quote unquote, stipulated facts in it. Prior to that settlement agreement, there was deposition testimony from Schrader's president and project manager that no contractor, them or any subcontractor, should be assessed with liquidated damages or monetary deductions at all.
They because said it was due to high water
it
levels?
It was due to, yeah, natural conditions, high water, project mismanagement by MnDOT, in improper or impossible scheduling of the project. Once, you know, going back to the original timeline of the project, it was supposed to be done in November of 2019. Both Schrader and MnDOT, even before that time, realized that the conditions, the natural conditions on site, did not allow that to be the project.
And can you clarify for me, is there record evidence that, we referred to this, a road or a bridge, was opened back up to the public before your client even started the riprap?
Before they did most of their work, correct.
Okay. So your client's delay didn't impact, or there's evidence that your client's delay did not impact the public's ability to use the road or the bridge.
Right. Under the original schedule for the project, most of my client's work was going to be done while the road was closed. But when the natural conditions caused delays beyond the fall of 2019, then even the proposed revised schedules that got circulated in that winter of 2019-20 showed my client's work mostly being done after the roadway had opened up to live traffic. And there's notes, several notes in the emails, handwritten notes saying that this would be done. It's even noted on the schedule itself. So yeah, there's a complete lack of evidence here that my client's work was on any sort of critical path to open the roadway to use by the public.
So what you're seeking, A, you want judgment in your favor. If not, B, you want us to reverse summary judgment for the state on the theory that you have a right to present defenses?
Yes. That's our alternative argument, technically.
There needs
correct.
To be a determination of the amount of damage, if any, that your client is responsible for.
Correct.
And there are genuine issues of material fact that impact that, having to do with was there delay, who caused the delay, who should be at fault for the delay. And I think another argument of yours is, depending on what the delay is and the damages resulting, we might have an issue of is liquidated damages provision punitive or not.
Correct. Yes, correct.
Got it.
Judge Smith asked for questions of material fact. There's additional questions of material fact about the timeline itself. Once the project restarted in 2020, there was a lot of high water even through the spring of 2020 that pushed construction back. And this was at a time, you know, my client Goman removed the riprap in 2019, but was waiting in 2020 to replace it. And there are email communications between my client and Schrader showing that even though these proposed revised schedules showed us starting work in early June of 2020, by mid-July, the excavator subcontractor, a separate company that's not even a part of this lawsuit, States Borders, hadn't even done its site prep work where we needed to come in and do our work of replacing that riprap stone. So they were weeks, if not months, behind schedule, and they're a critical path task that comes before Goman's.
So you would argue that that shows that that
yeah.
delay was beyond your control. You couldn't
right.
have installed if you wanted to.
Yeah, and there's several communications in the record. So that's another question of material fact. But yeah, you mentioned also the question of whether the liquidated damages provision is punitive. And it certainly is in regards to Goman. If you look at it in context of the subcontract, Goman is a contractor that is doing work, like we said, separate from the ultimate purpose of this project, which is to reopen the road and bridge to use by the public. That part of the project, the main purpose of the project, wasn't dependent on Goman. So to say that $3,000 per day in liquidated damages is not punitive against Goman is just baseless, because
and that $3,000 was tied to the initial deadline, which was get the road open.
No. The liquidated damages provision ties to the contract completion date. The monetary deductions tie to the interim completion date, which is the opening of the roadway with all the safety systems in place.
And your argument is we had nothing to do with
Yeah, the monetary deductions, our argument is we had nothing to do with that because we were not the contractor that was to rebuild the road.
But that settlement amount includes an award for monetary deductions.
Yeah, over $300,000 worth, correct. Okay.
Could you touch upon your last argument? I think I understand what you're getting at, and maybe you can just tell me if I do, and that is this offset that the district court judge granted against a judgment for the state representing amounts that had already been held back from your client. Yeah. You're saying that that is, in actuality, the equivalent of an award of judgment for your client.
Correct.
Okay.
So if you look at the district court's order, it's very clear. I think it's paragraph 8 of the conclusions of law. I don't have it in front of me at the moment. But the district court was very clear that it was awarding the full $1.455 million in delay-related claims. That includes both liquidated damages and monetary deductions. And that's the amount settled for between the respondents. And the district court was very clear that it was awarding the entirety of that amount against Goman. And then it said, but I am offsetting the $655,000 and change from that award. So they entered judgment for $900,000.
Why is that happens often? Why do you think that means the judge granted summary judgment for your client when the judge expressly denied summary judgment for your client?
Sure. Because the $600,000, we made a summary judgment motion saying we are owed the rest of the money due to us under our subcontract for the work that we completed. That was that amount of money. The judge can't offset that amount of money from an award against us of $1.4 million unless that money belongs to us. If they denied our request for the $600,000+, then we would owe the full $1.4 million.
Understood. Thank you. You'll have some rebuttal time, and at that opportunity we can chat about the issue of the settlement agreement and its validity and whether the court should have approved it.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Eric Johnson, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Commissioner of Transportation. This is, as Judge Smith identified, review of summary judgment. And really the question is whether there are genuine issues of material fact on the one claim that was against a company that took on a $3 million project. Now, the district court made 26 statements identifying facts that are not disputed in record evidence. Now, you heard some arguments and averments from counsel and saw them written in his brief that there are genuine issues of material fact. What you don't see is cites to the record. But now, for example, one that you asked about, Judge Larkin.
Okay. I'm going to stop you because I have questions for you, and we have reviewed the record, so we've actually found some of the things, and you are absolutely right. We do require cites to the record, and an attorney makes our job much more difficult if they're not provided, but we do have the ability to look at the record. So before you go too far down that path, I want to just ask some basic big picture questions. Is it the state's position that appellant does not get to litigate the amount of indemnification for which it is responsible?
It's the state's argument that the appellant had an opportunity to litigate that claim because the indemnity claim was part of the underlying lawsuit. And when they brought their summary judgment motion, they had an opportunity and obligation to put before the district court evidence that supported their position that they were not responsible for the almost a year delay. Okay. That
but
happened.
As I understand it, their argument in support of summary judgment in its favor was that there's a notice provision. Schroeder didn't comply with it. So that I don't know that they were focused on it. It's what they were obligated to present, as you have just described it, seems to me to be a defense to your motion for summary judgment. In other words, said we're entitled to summary judgment, and they could come in and say, well, no, you're not. There are disputes about the proper allocation of damages in this case.
Well, I've been both a defense counsel and a plaintiff's counsel, and if I want summary judgment that gets me out of a case, and I have an affirmative claim, as they did, and a claim against me, as they did from nearly the outset, if I want out, I will bring a summary judgment that asks for two things: prevail on my claim, and there's no basis on the other one. On that notice issue, Your Honor, you're correct that there isn't any consequence in the subcontract for the absence of notice.
And let me ask you about that, because you point that out in your briefing in a footnote. So my question for you is, how is the notice provision on which the district court relied and on which the state relies that requires appellant to have given notice of potential delays and sought additional time? Well, that notice provision doesn't include any language saying, and if appellant fails to give notice, appellant may not raise these defenses. So I'm not seeing how either notice provision differs from the other. There are notice provisions with no explicit consequence that don't refer to the relevant provisions.
I can answer that, Your Honor.
Okay.
You'll have to bear with me because I'm going to talk about both contracts now.
Okay.
Initially, we have the contract between MnDOT and Schroeder. That one has both notice provisions and explicit language, like in Buckman, that if you don't comply, you waive the claim. So now, in the context of that contract, Schroeder had given notice of couple things that affected their schedule. Mainly high water was the big one. There was about a week for some H pile and some other things that were really not in dispute.
Does that contract between Schroeder and the state govern the subcontractor's notice provision?
I'm getting to that, Your Honor. Like I said, you know, this would take a little bit more
Well, here's the thing. The district court didn't explain. The district court just said appellants required to give notice, didn't give notice, on the hook for damages. No explanation. I did not see an explanation in your brief. I saw, well, the district court correctly found that failure to give notice means they're out. We win. And now you're telling me, well, it's a long explanation, and we have 9 minutes and 44 seconds left. So
if you can give us a short explanation. I'll try to do it as briefly as I can. Since Schroeder gave notice for a few things, we said, give us your best day, how much time extension can all those things collectively get you? We say, if we concede to all that, you still got all this time. Therefore, you are stuck with it, because you didn't give notice of any of those delays. If there were reasons, you waived them. You don't have a defense. Do you have a defense? They don't. That's what led to the claim against Schroeder. Now, Schroeder's sitting there with that liability. Now, they have an indemnity claim. Now, they put evidence in the record. It's document 36 that all of the rest of that delay was caused by Goman, because of the year it took them to do their 3 months of work. There wasn't contradictory evidence that said, no, we were only responsible for a portion of it, or no, we asked for a month of time extension.
I understand, but isn't that appellant's complaint, that the state and Schroeder came up with these stipulations as part of their agreement, and now, according to the district court, they're binding on appellant? An appellant saying, I've got defenses under the contract. I want to raise my defenses.
Well, they had an opportunity and obligation to do that to the district court. And if they chose not to, if they chose to make different arguments or highlight different evidence or put different evidence to the district court, they had that opportunity. And that doesn't mean that the district court erred if they now say, well, we have additional arguments that if you send it back, we'll try to make then and try to win with a second bite at this case.
Let me ask this. In the district court's finding, it says Goman was bound by the project schedule through the terms of the general contract and subcontract, which were unambiguous.
Yes.
It looks like
there are all kinds of ambiguities about the timing of this project. And I don't see, I see that everything changed.
Well, that argument wasn't made to the district court, Your Honor. And so discussions about ambiguity cannot be a basis for reversal, because there was never an argument about ambiguity made by Goman to the district court.
But
they had a completion date of August of 2020 under the schedule. They never asked for, Goman did, they never asked for a time extension. They never said, we need an extra 30 days because of this, or an extra 60 days because of this, and here's how you get there.
You concede that that was impossible to?
No, not in 2020. When the schedule came out in March of, thank you for allowing me to clarify that, Your Honor.
Yeah.
When the schedule came out in March of 2020, the water had been in 2019.
Okay, so the original schedule had changed.
Yeah, it was first created in November, so they had the whole winter season to prepare for it.
Right.
It said you have to be there in May, finish in 90 days. That's August of 2020. There's no evidence that they couldn't do that. And so now when that date comes and goes, and they don't ask for a time extension, they're still there for almost another year.
I have a question, because it was my impression that the state was taking the position that, well, it's my understanding that the state argued in district court, we're not here to argue about how much Goman has to indemnify. That's been settled. We're just here to collect that settlement amount pursuant to the assignment of the claim to the state. I understood the state to be saying that we're not here to litigate how much Goman owes or how much of the damage Goman is responsible. Is that not the state's position?
The state's position, if you're talking about what was the state's argument at summary judgment,
mm-hmm.
The state's argument there was there's a remaining portion of delay damages. The only evidence in the record is that Goman, who had 40% of this $7.8 million contract, was responsible for it. That was undisputed, unrefuted evidence.
Here's what I'm thinking of. I'm looking at the state's brief, page 27. The assignment of claims in MDOT settlement with Schroeder did not allow MDOT to assert its contractual claims for delay damages against Goman directly. Rather, the assignment allowed MDOT to assert Schroeder's indemnity claim.
Yes.
All right. Hold on. There's more to it. I spoke too soon. Oh, carry on.
Well, because the context of the indemnity claim is now Schroeder's sitting there with, now bear in mind, they're the ones who are going to have to report on their next bid that they got socked with liquidated damages, not Goman. So they're sitting there with unavoidable liability for almost $1.5 million. They have an indemnity provision, and they're, in their mind, all of that was caused by Goman's delay. And that's backed up by the testimony that's unrefuted in the record, Doc 36. And so then, based on A, we've got liability of $1.5 million against us. B, we believe Goman is responsible for all of it. C, there's an indemnity provision that allows us to pursue it. And D, there's no evidence in the record that suggests that it should, that it's anything less than that. And on that indemnity claim.
Well, what if the evidence in the record in, from the summary judgment proceedings includes emails where Schroeder was saying none of this delay is compensable. It should be attributed to natural causes. Or Goman is complaining that, well, the site work's not done. We can't be installing riprap because the surface hasn't been prepared. Don't those things indicate that it's not as clear-cut, or at least there's an issue of fact?
I mean, I can tell you why neither of those items
okay.
creates a genuine issue of a material fact. Okay, I'm going to first say you've got opinion testimony of a principal of the contractor saying, well, we don't think there should be any liquidated damages assessed against us. I guarantee you every contractor will say that in every case in which someone seeks to enforce liquidated damages. But under the terms of the contract, an owner's opinion is not a defense to whether they're assessed or not. They're assessed automatically unless, pursuant to the terms of the contract, time extensions are sought, justified, and granted. Now, particularly here, I can see why the principal of Schroeder didn't believe he was responsible for any liquidated damages, because after the time extension, they believed that all the remaining delay was caused by Goman, not them. So that's consistent with the result. Now, second, you said there's an email or two that when Goman sent two workers to the site to start sorting rocks, that some of the grading wasn't done. What the record lacks, though, is that Goman had any workers available to be working during that period, whether they were ready to go, whether they were waiting for anything. They didn't send any workers down until the 23rd of July. When they finally showed up, there's not one shred of evidence that you can find in this record that can explain why it took them from that point a year to do that work. And because nothing was ever raised by them to Schroeder, let's assume hypothetically, Your Honor, mm-hmm. that say in September, the grader walked off the job for 3 weeks and Goman could not do anything for 3 weeks. I'm making that up. There's no evidence of that. What would happen then is that Goman would give notice to Schroeder saying, I'm delayed, I want a 3 week time extension. And then if that grader is, you know, has an excusable reason, Schroeder makes a claim to MnDOT and says, we need a 3 week time extension. None of that happened. So Schroeder gets stuck with that delay, but it didn't happen. There wasn't an excusable issue ever identified from the day they finally had some workers show up until a year later when they finished working. When they got that schedule in November of 2019, their own project manager says that's a realistic, doable schedule. And now, on that notice, Your Honor, I don't have it in the brief. It's in the record, though. But there's testimony from Goman's project manager that when they received that email that says, you know, we're going to assess liquidated damages against you if this doesn't pick up, that they understood it. They understood that they were being put on notice that they could get liquidated damages if they didn't get on schedule. And that's document 38 at 25 and 26. So also, the only argument in the briefing to the district court was they said, we didn't get any notice. Then you show up at the hearing, and they're saying, okay, we understand. We got this email that talks about liquidated damages. And in one sentence of argument, he says, that's not enough. But the testimony of their own project manager says they understood it. So it was notice, and it was understood as notice. But yet ultimately, Judge, even if there had been no notice, there was. I mean, that's undisputed in the record, and the district court got that right. If there was no notice, that would not be a prohibition on enforcing indemnity. You might not know what your damages are until the project's over. And then you look down at it, and you've suffered damages. And you know that the reason you suffer damages is because somebody else did something, and they agreed to indemnify you.
Counsel, I have one additional question. I know we're a little over on time, but I think it's important, and that is the settlement. You write in your brief that the settlement did not impair any of Goman's defenses to indemnity. Goman remained free to argue any legal defenses that it had before the settlement and to indicate any evidence that supported any defenses on the facts. And the settlement did not eliminate any meritorious legal defenses that Schroeder could have brought from which Goman would have benefited. So your position is Goman had these defenses under the contract. The settlement didn't eliminate Goman's ability to raise those defenses. And you're saying the reason Goman can't raise those defenses now is because the record was not sufficient to raise a genuine issue of material fact as to those defenses?
Could you be more specific about what defense you're saying?
The defense in the contract that says Goman's responsible for damages resulting from delay unless the delay was caused by circumstances not within the control of Goman. So in other words, Goman showing up and saying, well, yeah, there was delay, but here's some reasons we couldn't do what we were supposed to do, such as high water, such as the surface hasn't been prepared.
I'm not saying they couldn't raise those defenses to the district court, because there was an indemnity claim against them for the full amount and evidence that they were responsible for the full amount. That was their opportunity that they'd had and an obligation from day one when Schroeder first sent them an indemnity claim in the pleadings.
So your argument really is they can't raise those defenses here as a basis to get reversal because they didn't raise that as an issue at the summary judgment proceeding.
They didn't put evidence in the record and argue it to the district court as a basis to deny summary judgment.
All right. But the evidence, we have the record, so
yes,
we can look at what's there. Our review of summary judgment is de novo. So I'm just trying to pin down your argument, and your argument is we shouldn't entertain
arguments
Goman's
that weren't made to the
argument.
Consistent with multiple decisions of this court that you have an opportunity at the district court.
Okay, but we also have case law that says we can deem something
you can do whatever you want, yes.
The argument, yeah. And I guess I'll ask counsel for Goman to tell us this. In district court, did Goman say, look, there are issues here about how much of this damage we're responsible for? And you're telling us Goman didn't make that argument.
Correct. And that okay, to the extent that counsel says that there are arguments or evidence in the record, I haven't seen any cites to them, and I'm not aware of them.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Counsel, I think you should start by responding to the assertion that your client made no argument in the district court summary judgment proceedings that there's issues of fact regarding the amount of indemnification your client should be responsible for, and therefore you can't raise those issues here and now.
Yeah. And would you cite to the record when you do that?
Yeah, absolutely. They did raise that. There's multiple references to the testimony of the Schroeder representatives of the fact that no liquidated damages should be warranted here. So I don't have our summary judgment motion memorized, but I'm positive that that came up both in our writings and in the transcript of the hearing.
Okay.
That this is raising a question of material fact on causation of delay on the part of Goman, because Schroeder, a different party to the lawsuit, testified under oath that there are other reasons for the delay, and that no delays were appropriate against any contractor. So that's a question of material fact right there.
And you're saying that was raised in district court?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And I'm going to point you to my brief now on appeal here. The assertion was made that there's not a shred of evidence of other causes of delay. I block quoted an email on page 17 of our brief.
Could you answer this question for me having to do with the settlement?
Yeah.
You say the settlement is unfair or unreasonable, collusion. The district court shouldn't have approved it. If everybody is on the same page that Goman is allowed to raise its defenses, its causation defenses under the contract, as the state has now said, how does the settlement prejudice you? As I understood your argument, it's like, well, the settlement's prejudicial because it has established the amount of damages and we're not being allowed to contest the amount of damages or contest the amount of attorney's fees.
Yeah. Well, it's prejudicial and more so unreasonable. The case law on whether these settlement agreements are allowed talks about that there needs to be hard bargaining done between the parties who are settling, and that just simply wasn't done here. On one hand, you have a party, Schroeder, coming into settlement negotiations firmly denying any sort of liquidated damages being appropriate on this case. Yet, knowing that they're going to point the finger and lay blame on Goman, mostly as a scapegoat, considering all the factual issues we have here on who's responsible for delays, they blame Goman for $1.5 million of delay-related damages when Goman's contract wasn't even $3 million. That's more than half their contract price. So no, of course there wasn't hard bargaining here. This was a completely unreasonable contract, or excuse me, settlement agreement, because anybody on the record we had who was negotiating would not have settled for an amount that high on the delay-related claims. That shows a complete lack of hard bargaining. So the result of it is, yeah, we've got two parties who are unfairly ignoring a lot of the factual questions that are in the record, and I wanted to make sure I made this point. My brief, from pages 16 to 19, every single sentence has a citation to the record of communications and emails that talk about states' borders in particular not having the site ready at certain times that we were supposed to be doing our work.
And those were presented to the district court?
Well, they're in the district court record, yeah. They were presented in the summary judgment materials across motions by both parties, yes. So these, yeah, and I cite to, in my appeal brief, I cite to the district court record, which appellate document index number that they're found in. And we have a settlement agreement here that says the project completion date is August 12th of 2020, and we've got emails which have citations to the record in my material showing that States Borders was still doing site prep work in September of 2020. So how we're supposed to be done by August 12th, when the site prep work that our work depends on is still being done a month later, is beyond me. You just can't say that there's not a question of material fact here. And as to what happened in the district court, why the district court seemed to just rubber stamp the settlement agreement, I have no idea what happened. But we're here on de novo review, and it's up to this court on summary judgment to decide if there are fact questions, and there clearly are. They're in the record, they're cited, the record is cited in the briefing materials here. The only question we have here to look at as far as whether the district court abused its discretion is whether it should have voided the settlement agreement itself. And that, I think, because there was no analysis done, despite the claims made at the district court level by my client that this was a collusive and secretive agreement, the district court, in its analysis of whether that settlement agreement was valid, completely ignored those arguments and instead solely commented on the judicial efficiency of the settlement agreement and didn't look to the negative impact and unfairness it ultimately had on my client, Goman.
And you made those arguments to the district court?
Yeah, that's in the transcript because, frankly, the settlement agreement, a copy of it, was not provided to us until the day reply briefs were due in the cross motions for summary judgment. Even though the agreement was referenced in the original motion submitted by MnDOT, they didn't give us a copy of it until briefing was done on summary judgment. So yes, in the transcript of the hearing, you will find argument by Mr. Hansmeyer, Goman's counsel, alleging that that settlement agreement was collusive and prejudicial.
Well, thank you both for your arguments and your briefing. Complicated stuff. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.